This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salveson.
XS Manchester.
Welcome to the XS Long Player. I'm Jim Salveson, and this is a podcast that looks back at some of the classic albums of our time, some of the greatest ever LPs. And today, I'm talking about Cooler Shaker's debut album K, released back in 1996. And an album that became the fastest-selling debut album in the UK since Oasis and Definitely Maybe, which, by the way, is another album you can hear discussed on this podcast series. I talked to Alan McGee about that, so zoom back in the podcast feed to find it. But we are talking about K today, and I'm joined by Crispian and Alonza for the band to discuss its conception, recording, and a bit of the infamous fallout after the album as well. This, in my view, is one of the most creative albums of the Britpop era, but also had a few standout singles on it. Tracks that are still played on radio today, like Tatva and Hey Dude, which you might remember was only kept off the number one spot when it was released by the Spice Girls. But that's quite enough from me. Let's get stuck into this. Crispian Mills and Alonza Bevan from Cooler Shaker discussing their debut album K on the XS Long Player. Welcome to the XS Long Player, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Here we are.
Am I right in thinking that the first shoots of success for Cooler Shaker began here in Manchester? Because I think, I might have this wrong, but I think you won a competition within the city in Manchester, and that resulted in you subsequently getting the record deal with Columbia that went on to you releasing your debut album.
It's true. There's been a lot of intersections with Manchester in our career that have proved to be both fateful and fortuitous.
Well, yeah. I mean, in the city was a great, like, a, I guess, an industry kind of festival at the time. We won that joint winners with Placebo, wasn't it, that year, I think?
You know, I think we were getting a bit of heat from the record companies, and finally, after having kind of been ignored for we kept changing our name every 6 months because the record companies didn't want to know, and we kept changing our name and submitting new demos. They sound a bit similar to that. But we started to get heat. Some friends of ours were in a band called Reef, and they started to do well, and we went on tour with them, and people started to take notice. And our manager, Kevin, who's from round Manchester way, said, "You got to do this, lads. This is important." And we said, "Oh, we're not going to go being tarts for the music industry." And we had all that attitude going. I said, "No, seriously, it will really help me do my job." So we went and we did it. And it actually turned out to be just loads and loads of gigs going on everywhere. Yeah. And then somehow, you know, they were like joint winners. But we didn't take it seriously because how can you win? How can you really? It was like Battle of the Bands, you know. But it did help. It did help. And then the industry down in London, those villains down there, we had a couple of labels bidding for us, which was nice.
Did it feel like a bit of a sliding doors moment? Or do you think it probably would have happened for you anyway? You were getting enough attention at that point that sooner or later a deal was going to come.
The most memorable sliding door was the one that led to the Stallion Sauna, which is the where we were staying, the bed and breakfast.
It was the Carlton Hotel. I don't know if it's still there. It was on the recommended list of hotels for poor Southerners coming up to stay. And it was a very colourful hotel. There was a flyer for the 24-hour male-only sauna. And we realised that was at the hotel we were staying at.
Big shout out to the Stallion Sauna for making that very memorable in the city.
We gave them our award, didn't we? We got an award for In the City. I think it was a banana with two apples placed suggestively at the base, sprayed silver. And I think we donated that to the Carlton Hotel.
It's still there now in the sauna.
There's been a fair few people in Manchester who have been caught out by the 24-hour male saunas not having any sauna facilities of any aspect at all. I don't think you'd be the first. Going back to signing that deal with Columbia, I think there were 9 months between the deal being signed, the ink being dry, and the debut album, which is K, which we're talking about coming out. It went on to become the fastest selling debut album since Definitely Maybe. At the time, it was when British bands were kind of ruling the waves, so that is a big achievement. But did it feel meteoric at the time? Did it feel like it was a real rapid rise? And did that success catch you off guard?
So a friend of mine described it as a balloon in a gale, and it certainly felt like that. I mean, there's a certain amount of work that you do where, you know, you plan, you know, your work, and you plan your music, and your manager's making plans, and then there's luck, and you get luck that comes in, and unexpected things like Noel Gallagher turning up to a gig we did and offering us Nebworth, and then Chris Evans starting to really support us, and certain things that just tip the balance. And it was fast, but because we'd been working for a long time as a band, writing and developing and slogging it out, it felt like a continuation rather than that 9 months. But for a lot of people, it seemed like we just came out of nowhere.
So did you feel ready for it, or did the success and the big studios and the suits from London add kind of pressure onto you as a band that maybe you hadn't experienced before?
No, nobody can be ready for that. No, because it's the end of your privacy. It's the end of your innocence, actually, because, you're sort of public property. The business is pretty brutal. So you can't prepare for it, but you can just sort of, stiff British upper lip. That's what we did.
We didn't have time to think, did we? I mean, at the same time as we're making an album, we were also touring. Were we not playing with the presidents of the United States at that time? And we were doing gigs at the same time. We were doing little sessions. We'd go into a studio for a week or 2 weeks, cut some tracks, and then we would be out on the road again. It was really, we really didn't have time to think about it. Well, I didn't anyway.
Yeah, no, you didn't have time to use the toilet.
I didn't have time to have a good, yes.
I'm surprised to hear it was that frantic, because on the album I hear a lot of ideas, I hear a lot of experimentation, and that doesn't seem to fit with a band that are kind of up against it in terms of production, because normally for that kind of thing you need a creative space, you need kind of the room for things to gestate and develop. So was there a conflict there between what you wanted to do and that pressure and that timescale?
We had a lot of time to get our act together before it, you know, we actually started cutting the record. And then we had John Leckie, who we loved because he'd done Stone Roses. It was a huge album for us. And he'd also done The Dukes of Stratosphere, which was another big psychedelic album that we loved. And so we would record with him, and actually he would keep things ticking over while we went off to do some gigs, and we came back and we'd meet him in another studio, maybe somewhere on the road. He'd meet us in somewhere like Chipping Norton or something. He'd pop up like a musical gnome, and he'd be waiting for us.
Was he kind of a father figure in those sessions, coming in with his experience? Like you say, he worked with the Roses and he'd produced their debut. Was he a kind of guiding light through those experiences for you?
He was he was like a magical creature.
A gnome, I think, is a good way of describing him. Yeah, he's like a mystical creature from the underworld, and a really talented engineer, yeah.
And we loved also the fact that he goes back, he engineered Instant Karma, John Lennon's track, and he was there in the studio, you know, tape-hopping for George Harrison on All Things Must Pass. He's like probably one of the most influential Cooler Shaker records. And so, yeah, you know, there's in The Hobbit, there's like Gandalf the Grey, and then there's the other guy in brown who has like sparrows living in his hair. That's a bit John Leckie. You want to understand John Leckie? That is that guy. He doesn't have sparrows living in his hair, but he lives in that kind of
house. I don't know about that.
Magical. Magical. Mushrooms.
Yeah, movie mushrooms.
I'm going to ask you both to pick a moment off the album in a moment. It can be a highlight. It can be a memory. It can be something that casts a memory from the recording. Just kind of pick out a moment for me in just a second. But I want to talk about, before we do that, a great example, I think, of pushing boundaries and Govinda. One of the singles off it that got to number 7 in the charts, did incredibly well, and I'll wager it is probably, I've not researched this, but I think it's a pretty good bet that it is the only ever UK top 10 single to be sung in Sanskrit. Did it feel like you were making bold choices at that stage? Did you have record bosses that were kind of banging on the door, demanding that you recorded or released another Hey Dude, rather than tracks like Govinda?
Yes, actually, you're absolutely right. There was a bit of understanding, and then there was also those kind of moments where we had a track which was ended up on our second album called Shower Your Love, and they were really very insistent that we put that on the album and that become a single. And we felt like we wanted the spiritual thing and the Indian, you know, sounds and the live energy of Govinda, and we went for it. Yeah, we really stuck to our guns there, but we'd already had 3 hits, so we were in a pretty strong position to ask for that request humbly.
Right, I'm going to ask you both to pick a moment of this album. Alonza, you can go first. Is there a particular track or a moment on it that sparks off memories for you from its creation?
I'm trying to think. I do remember recording Magic Theatre. I remember tracking the piano, and I remember tracking the piano again while John Leckie was messing around with the time of the tape machine, which gave it that rather warbly kind of chorus feel. It was just an interesting technique that really worked, and it made up for my bad piano playing as well.
There was still a lot of effects and production techniques that were you know, proper analog, using tape. And it was still the very tail end of the analog recording age.
That's the great thing. Yeah, we did get to record on real tape, going through a big desk, and it really felt like making a record. It's true.
Do you look back at that fondly, or do you kind of think, when you look back, if you'd made K in the age of digital, that you would have had a better product, or a worse product for that matter?
I don't know. I tell you, one of the most memorable moments for me on that album was being in a classic studio in London called Townhouse and slogging away on trying to get the drums sounding right for Tapa. And we had something in mind, and John, I think, had something else in mind. And we were moving the mics here and moving the mics there. And after about 6 hours of this, he was pulling his thatched hair out, and he said, "I don't understand why you guys won't just go with this sound. I mean, this room is perfectly good." We said, "No, it doesn't work. It's just, the room sounds awful. It's all stone." He says, "It's worked. It's good enough for Phil Collins." At that moment, we just said, "Right, next, moving out there, get it out."
We grabbed a drum each and moved it into the other room.
Actually, to be fair, there was a classic room. That was where he recorded the legendary. I can feel it coming in here tonight. It was good enough for him, but it wasn't good enough for us.
Fair enough.
Well, we were going for a retro thing, and the 80s were then, the 80s were not cool. Okay. Now they've become post-ironic cool.
I want to talk about the tail end of this album, which I imagine probably wasn't a period you look back on too fondly. There were some comments that you made, Crispian, about the well-documented comments now about the origins of the swastika in mythical Indian culture. It resulted in a newspaper story that suggested that you had dabbled in Nazism, which is a weird statement. When you look at the themes and the lyrics from your music, you can tell you're not a
dabbled
band full of right-wing supporting idealists. Yeah, dabble with Nazism. Yeah, that's a thing, isn't it? Can people dabble in Nazism? But anyway, we've got 25 years now since that happened, between the kind of press stories and the fallout from that. How do you look back on it now? Do you look back on it and think you were completely screwed over by the British press, or do you look back on it and say, "Oh, I wish I'd been more careful with my words at the time"?
Well, speaking as a half-Jewish Krishna kid, it was pretty weird. But, you know, it's kind of like now with the trolling that you get on social media, or when the mob, you know, kind of like gets kind of all rallies around somebody's comment. Like, you know, I think the last time it kind of happened off social media was like with Russell Brand and the whole thing with, you know, Jonathan Ross and that phone call to Sax's daughter. it's like you just need to shut up and just let them get on with it. You know, let everybody shout and throw stuff at you. It's just what happens. It's just what happens when you get into that world. And, you know, it just, it's like a, it's storming a teacup, really. What you can't do when you're in the public eye is take it, any of it seriously, because it's not even really happening to you. It's just happening to this this person that exists in the media. And then when my mum was a kid and she started making films and she became really, really famous, and it was a shock to her as well, even though her dad was a film star. You know, it was a shock, and she realized that the person on these posters wasn't her. It was someone else completely, and it was a big shock, and you kind of have to readjust.
Did it tarnish the experience? Did it tarnish the period that should have been an amazing period for the band, releasing your debut album? But did it kind of sully that experience, and did it delay what came next as well? Because there was a bit of a gap between that and the second album, I think, and where you should have been riding the wave.
We did. I mean, you know, actually success and fame is just puts the pressure on. And I remember really laughing when Supergrass were going into the studio to make their second album, and they announced the working title of their album, which was just Second Album Syndrome. And you know, because you get that pressure to, you have to, you know, have to replicate that same success. I mean, the most complicated moment of our second album was being in the studio with Rick Rubin and George Tekulius producing us at the same time. Both guys are well over 6 foot and quite big fellows with giant beards, and we're all quite sort of skinny Englishmen. And I thought, how did we get here? And at that point, yeah, you've got proper second album syndrome.
How do you feel about this album now, your debut? Like I say, over 25 years since its release. Do you look back on it fondly and see it as a perfect piece of work? Do you hear the imperfections? What's your relationship like with it now?
It's just the energy. It's the urgency that I hear. And yeah, that's why I think when you know, everything I do now, you will always, that first music that you ever made, will always reference that and gauge and take your own pulse and say, well, how am I doing and where am I at? Masses of ambition on that album too, that, you know, you're still, and I'm personally, I know you, Alonso too, we're both still trying to not just match it, but we're trying to, you know, go beyond it, because we're still searching for that. The Moody Blues, you know, we're looking for the magic chord that's going to, you know, save the world.
Do you go back to that album, Alonso, when you're kind of, well, you've just made the album, the new album, First Congregational Church of Eternal Love and Free Hugs. Do you kind of go back to Kay as a reference point for what you're going to do with new music as and when it comes?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's where we come from. It's our start point. It's really hard, obviously, for us to, for myself anyway, to be objective about Kay. Certainly, yeah, that it's that live energy that I think what was we got from Kay. It did feel like a young band that had loads of energy, as Crispin just said. It's and then you do strive for that, absolutely. You try and deny your aching knees and the years that pass and go for that, you know, that excitement, that energy, that youthful energy, absolutely.
The best band and the best gig I ever saw was The Who in 1999. You know, rock and roll is about a spirit. It is about an attitude and a passion. And if you are filled with the Holy Spirit, then it doesn't actually matter what age you are. You just are infected with it. And then you connect with the audience. And that night I saw The Who. They just blew every other band I'd ever seen away. They just had it, still had it. So for me, that's actually one of those formative experiences. And Kay was an ambitious album because it wants to be up there, and it's still aspiring to, you know, be in the company of the giants.
I think that's a perfect statement on which to finish our conversation about Cooler Shaker Kay, the classic album that's been under the microscope today on the XS Long Player. Crispian, Alonso, absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you, Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
How cool was that? Crispian and Alonso sharing their memories and thoughts about their debut album, Kay. I particularly enjoyed the story about the Stallion Sauna in my hometown of Manchester. If you enjoyed that and this is your first time visiting the XS Long Player, make sure you listen to some of the other podcasts in the series, some of the other brilliant albums. There's a lot of 90s albums in there. discussed with the people that made them. Just spin back in the timeline to find it and subscribe to this podcast feed because there'll be another XS Long Player at some point soon. Cheers for your ears. Have a good one.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.